All right. Have you ever wrestled with this question about God's sovereignty, God's control, God's rule of the world? Have you ever found yourself thinking, here I have gone along in the years of my life, and in the span of my life, it looks like things are going along about the same, that the world has its way a lot of times, and that there are injustices that are not resolved, and there are things that I wish God would take care of that He hasn't yet, at least in an obvious way, and I struggle with that. How can I believe that God is at work when it looks like things are going along just about like they always have? Remember, don't you, that in 2 Peter 3, some of the mockers used that very thing to make light of the idea that the Lord will come, or that there'll be a judgment, or that there'll be an ultimate end to things. Well, in real time, that happens in the book, that question is wrestled with in the book, a little book of Habakkuk, which we started a study through last Lord's Day. And Habakkuk is a man who lives in the 7th century B.C., the 600s B.C., and the political and social and religious circumstances that he deals with happen over a period of, say, 85 years. In other words, a lifetime. And his questions are raised against that situation. I'd like this morning for us first to set the stage for this a little bit, and then to read the passage here. What we need to know is that internationally, I'm going to use just the idea of Judah and her neighbors here. International circumstances in the world at the time are these. First, the Assyrian, the mighty Assyrian Empire, has had control. Remember, they carried away the northern kingdom of Israel in 722 B.C. They repopulated the land with some people from other countries. That was their policy. The mighty Assyrians that Jonah, for example, didn't want to preach to, their capital was Nineveh. They invaded the land of Israel and Judah more times than one, and they dominated things. However, during this period of time when Habakkuk is living, the mighty Assyrian Empire is beginning its decline. You think about nations in the world who hold sway and who hold power, and then the ebb and flow of who is up and who is down, and who is gaining and who is losing and so forth. That goes on all the time, and it goes on imperceptibly to us because we don't have the ability maybe to zoom back and see the whole big picture like could be done later on in history. So what happens is, about the time that Habakkuk lives and preaches, this decline results in a clash in which the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, who have begun to ascend, are going to conquer the Assyrian Empire and to take control of them. About in 612 B.C., Nineveh fell to the Chaldeans, and the mighty Babylonians under kings like Nebuchadnezzar began to dominate. They had a different policy than the Assyrians did. Where the Assyrians would move populations and resettle, the Babylonians would conquer and take and leave, just emptiness and desolation and so forth. The Babylonians looked to be unconquerable. They looked to be terrible. They looked to be cruel and like they would be in power forever. They are arising in international affairs at the time. They are ascending. They are becoming the ones who are dominant. And caught in the middle of this is little Judah. And these are the people who live around Jerusalem, who are what's left out of the great nation that God entered into a covenant with and has made promises to, and has, with his covenant, enforced it with promises and penalties. And these people now are the ones that Habakkuk is thinking about. He's one of these. He lives and works in Jerusalem, and he sees what happens there, and he speaks of the circumstances in the lives of his people. So what are the circumstances in the lives of his people? Let's look at that for a few minutes now. So in Judah, and I'll write it up here, but I mean Judah and Jerusalem. And this, we call this the southern kingdom a lot of times, because the northern kingdom has now been displaced, and only Judah and Benjamin are left, and Benjamin is mighty small. So this is where the kings who are descendants of David hold sway and reign. And we need to think of about three of them for our purposes here. The first one is Manasseh. Manasseh reigned for 55 years in the early 600 BCs. So if you turn over with me to 2 Kings for a minute, we can set the stage for a lot of what we need to read in Habakkuk this way. 2 Kings 21. Manasseh could have been a great and good king because his father was Hezekiah. What can you tell me that you remember about Hezekiah? Anybody? All right, he was a good king. He was righteous and upright. He's the fellow who, when the capital was threatened, if you remember, he took the letter and spread it out before the Lord and prayed over it, and God delivered 185,000 of the enemy fell in one day, and they went back home and all of this. That was the Assyrians. Manasseh could have benefited from all that, but Manasseh comes to power, and let me just read a little of this. 2 Kings 21 and verse 2, starting. And he did, he is Manasseh, he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. In other words, the Canaanites. For he rebuilt the high places that Hezekiah his father had destroyed, and he erected altars for Baal and made Asherah. Now, Baal and the Asherah, as this translates it, are the male and female Canaanite fertility deities, so-called, the god and goddesses of the Canaanite. If you ever studied about the worship and the service of those idols, you'd know how disgusting their practices and so forth were. Disgusting is the kindest word that I could use of them. And he worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served them. What are the hosts of heaven? Sun, moon, stars. Manasseh leads the people of Israel, or of Judah, in thinking that the sun and the moon and stars control the fate of the people. All right? And he built altars in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem will I put my name. And he built altars for the host of heaven and the two courts of the house of the Lord. So he set up these altars to the pagan service of the heavenly bodies in the house of God. Now look at verse 6. And he made his son pass through the fire, which the ESV gives the sense of by translating, and he burned his son as an offering. He burned his own child as a sacrifice to pagan idols. And this is as low as you could sink. And he used fortune telling and dealt with mediums and necromancers, which means that he used witchcraft to summon up supposedly the dead and to communicate with the dead in order to find out what he should do about the future. I'm not sure how the dead are supposed to tell him what to do in the future, but that's what this man does. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. And the carved image of the Asherah that he had made, he set in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord said to David and Solomon, in this house where I've chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I'll put my name forever. So this house in which God's name was, Manasseh introduced all this stuff to, which in verse 9 is said to be, Manasseh led them astray to do more evil than the nations had done, whom the Lord destroyed before the people of Israel. One of our old elders told me one time, the Lord will either have to judge our country soon, or he'll have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, with Manasseh, that's what a man like Habakkuk would have thought as he contemplated the wrong that went on. Now, God was not totally idle with this, because verse 21 of chapter 10 and following of verse 10 and following of chapter 21 here said, start of verse 11, that God sent his servants the prophets. And these would be other prophets, some of whom maybe Habakkuk would have been familiar with, like Jeremiah, for example. But because Manasseh, king of Judah, has committed these abominations and done things more evil than all the Amorites did, that's the people of the land of Canaan, who were before him, and has made Judah also to sin with idols, therefore, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I'm bringing upon Jerusalem and Judah such disaster that the ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. I will stretch out over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria, the judgment, in other words, the plumb line of the house of Ahab, and I'll wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. The thing is, that declaration had been made, 75 or 80 years before Habakkuk, and things were still going on. Look at verse 16. Moreover, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood, till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to another, besides the sin that he made Judah to sin, that they did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. In other words, besides the idolatry, there was inhumanity and injustice, all in the days of Manasseh. So God has decided that he will judge, but he hasn't yet judged. And Habakkuk lives in that in-between time, when God has said he would, but he hasn't yet. Now, if Habakkuk could have drawn back and looked at the world circumstances, he could have observed that things were changing and something would have to give. But that's not what he sees here. Now, Manasseh is followed by Ammon, his son. Ammon reigned only 2 years, according to chapter 2 Kings 21, and then verse 19. And you notice in verse 20 it says, he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, as Manasseh his father had done. He walked in all the way in which his father walked, and served the idols that his father served, and worshiped them. He abandoned the Lord, the God of his fathers. Now, that means that he has done Manasseh one step worse. Manasseh has still, kept to what would outwardly look like some kind of consideration for the Lord, even if he did it by setting up idols in the house of the Lord. It was still the house of the Lord. But now Ammon, his son, has completely removed the Lord from consideration. He did not walk in the way of the Lord. Now Ammon gets killed by his own servants who conspired against him. And then King Josiah comes along, a very young child who, under the influence of the priest, does what's right. So I need to write our fellows up here. So we have Manasseh, who is evil in the extreme. Ammon, who's evil to the worst degree. And then we have Josiah, who turns out to be good, but whose influence does not reach the heart of the people. He's good, but not able to change the people. And that is the crucial thing that I want you to see here. So what happens is, as Josiah will rule for 31 years, and it turns out to be from about 639 to 609 B.C., something like that. During his time, they find the book of the law while they're trying to repair the temple. Things have gotten so bad, they've even lost the book of God's law, and much less any loyalty to God or any discipline, being disciplined by God's law. Josiah, in response to having the law read to him, leads the land in a great series of reforms. He removes the high places, all the idolatry. He restores the worship and service of God in the temple. They observe the Passover for the first time. There are a couple of crucial things in this process that I need to call your attention to, though. Look at chapter 23 of 2 Kings and verses 9 and 10, right along in there with me for a second. While it's talking about the ways in which Josiah broke down all of the terrible idols and the disgusting things that Manasseh and Ammon have introduced, verse 5 says he disposed the priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to make offerings in the high places at the cities of Judah and around Jerusalem, the ones who burned incense to Baal and so forth. He deposed them. Then when you get down to verse 9, while it goes ahead and describes all the rest of what Josiah does, it says, however, the priests of the high places did not come up to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem, but they ate unleavened bread among their brothers. What does that tell you? That's right. No matter what Josiah is doing, the hearts of even the priests have not been impacted enough that they would put God first and that they would devote themselves to Him. So while Josiah, in verse 10, is defiling the Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, that no one might burn his son or his daughter as an offering to Molech. All that's going on, but the hearts of the people are not completely being changed. By the way, what does the valley of the son of Hinnom become in the New Testament? It's the junkyard. Let me give you the name for it. It becomes Gehenna. What does that mean? All right, it's the word that's translated for hell. And you notice it's the place where they had burned their own children as sacrifices to their idols. That's the terrible image of hell that's used. Anyway, Josiah breaks all that down and defiles all of that and removes the shrines and so forth and that are there, and then he has them to keep the Passover because that's what's written in the book of the covenant, and he tried to establish the words of the law that were written in the book of the covenant. Now come all the way down to verse 26 of 2 Kings 23. Still, the Lord did not turn from the burning of his great wrath, by which his anger was kindled against Judah, because of all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. And the Lord said, I will remove Judah also out of my sight, as I have removed Israel. And I will cast off this city that I have chosen, Jerusalem, and the house of which I said, my name will be there. The thing is, what he decided to do in the days of Manasseh are now more than 30 years, maybe 50, maybe 70, maybe more than that, years behind, and God hadn't done it yet, at least not that Habakkuk could see. So now is about the time when Habakkuk speaks. Josiah goes up to a place called Megiddo to try to head off the king of Egypt who is passing through his land to fight against the Babylonians. Well, the king of Egypt kills Josiah at Megiddo, otherwise known as Armageddon. And then Jehoahaz takes the reign. And look at verse 32. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his fathers had done. So because the hearts of the people haven't been changed, they go right back to the moral and spiritual atmosphere of this time here. Manasseh and Amon's character, if you see. Now, plug into the middle of all of this Habakkuk and how things look to him just as an ordinary citizen who doesn't maybe get to read the prophetic editorials in the Jerusalem Post. He's just trying to make sense out of what he sees about life in the world around him. And he tries to reconcile that with the holy God who has the power and who can't let evil pass and who has to exercise judgment if there is any. And he is offended by what he sees. And it hurts him. It hurts him so much that in his prayers he has to say something. And that brings us back. And by the way, maybe I do need to read a little bit just about the moral atmosphere of the land here during this time. And I can do this from Jeremiah. And Jeremiah will in the early part of his preaching, will give us a good indication of what things are like among the people here. In Jeremiah 5, verse 1, he has run to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, look and take note, search her squares, see if you can find a man who does justice and seeks truth, that I may pardon her. So they do that. How many did they find? See if you can find one man who does justice and speaks truth. How many did they find? Right, Greeley, not one. Not one. And if you read on through this chapter, look at verse 7 and following, for example. How can I pardon you? Your children have forsaken me and have sworn by those who are no gods. When I fed them to the full, they committed adultery and trooped to the houses of the prostitutes. They were well-fed, lusty stallions, each neighing for his neighbor's wife. Shall not I punish them for these things, says the Lord, or declares the Lord. You look on down through this. Look at verse 25, or verse 23 of Jeremiah 5. But this people has a stubborn and rebellious heart. They've gone aside and gone away. They don't say in their hearts, let us fear the Lord our God, who gives the rain in its season, the autumn rain, the spring rain. In other words, they're not grateful. They have no reverence. Verse 25, your iniquities have turned these away. That's the harvest and so forth. Your sins have kept good from you. For wicked men are found among my people. They lurk like fowlers. In other words, people trying to trap birds lying in wait. They set a trap. They catch them like a cage full of birds. Their houses are full of deceit. They've become great and rich. They have grown fat and sleek. They know no bounds of evil. They judge not with justice. They cause the cause of the fatherless to make it prosper. They do not defend the rights of the needy. Shall I not punish them for their sins? Come down to chapter 6, verse 13 and following. For from the least to the greatest of them, everyone is greedy for unjust gain. From the prophet to the priest, everyone deals falsely. They have healed the wound of my people lightly by saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Were they ashamed when they committed abominations? No, they were not ashamed. They did not know how to blush. Therefore they shall fall among those who fall. That tells you a little bit about the moral and spiritual climate of the land as well. Now, into that, let's go back to Habakkuk now, to our prophet. And I mentioned to you last week, sometime just between the fall of Nineveh in 612 and the Babylonians' first invasion of the land in 605 or 606, the oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Can you tell me any other places in the Bible where the how long is raised like this? Brother Jan? Revelation especially, yes. In Revelation, the people who cry out, the souls underneath the altar who cry out, how long, O Master, holy and true? Or cry to you for violence, and you will not save. Now think about that, what he's saying. For violence in this city where the Manasseh is filled with blood from one end to the other, where people are trapped like birds, and then used. And Habakkuk, how long? I cry out and you won't save. Why do you make me see iniquity? What does he mean by that? You make me have to watch it and it not go away and not change. And why do you idly look at wrong? What does Habakkuk mean by that? Why do you idly look at wrong? Why is God complacent? Why does God appear to be complacent? Why does He seem to be inactive? Why does, in my language, why does He let them get away with it? Now be real honest. Have you thought that at any point just in this past 1 week? Of course you have. Or any other week? Of course you have. If you thought at all, why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. Look at his words. Destruction, violence, strife, contention, and perverted justice. And think about the whole climate that is involved in that. Would that bother a godly person? Wouldn't it? Would it bother a person of conscience and conviction to see that going on? Why does it bother a person of conscience and faith? Because we believe life has meaning. It's wrong. It can't stand if life is to have meaning. And that's what Habakkuk struggles with. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. That's what bothers him. In Jeremiah 12, Jeremiah says, why does the way of the wicked prosper? And this is the same thing that Habakkuk. The wicked surround the righteous. And this happens to the city of Jerusalem later on, literally, but Habakkuk sees it happening figuratively in the lives of the people. So justice goes forth perverted. Now I want to just introduce the last part of this, and we'll return to the last part of this next week in our class, Lord willing. Look among them. This is God's answer to Habakkuk's complaint. Now God could have said, I already said in the prophets back in Manasseh's time what I was going to do, and I haven't changed my mind. But that's not the way he answers Habakkuk. Look among the nations and see. What would you see if you looked among the nations? You would see one rising and one declining. For I am doing a work. One version says, I'm working a work in your days that you would not believe if told. Was that true? When he does tell Habakkuk, does Habakkuk believe it? So God says something true here. He's right. If I tell you, you won't believe it. For behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, the Babylonians here. Listen to the way he describes them. That bitter and hasty nations. A nation who marched through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. Would that be destruction and violence? So is God going to answer Habakkuk's plea about destruction and violence with more destruction and violence only now done by somebody else? Yes, he is. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swift to devour. They all come for violence, all their faces forward. In other words, you can't turn them back. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, and at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth. That means they lay siege, and they form a siege ramp to come over the wall of the city. They pile up earth and take it. Then they sweep by like the wind and go on. Guilty men whose own might is their God. Is that the answer that Habakkuk anticipated? It is action. God is at work. He is doing something. But Habakkuk's going to say, wait a minute. That'd only mean that a more wicked people would come to exercise judgment on this wicked people, and that doesn't seem right either. From bad to worse, that's right. But God is going to say, that's why it takes faith. That's why the righteous have to walk by faith. We're going to need to pursue this further farther next week, and we'll try to do that. Please, in your reading, work your way the rest of the way through chapter 1 and the first 4 verses of 2, please, for next week, if you would. And please notice, if you have a reference Bible that you read from, which I highly recommend, look up the parallel passages that are noted in these verses, and they'll provide you the historical setting for a lot of this. Appreciate your being with us this morning. Everybody have a great week this week, and remember to keep on praying for our people in your prayer time through this week. Appreciate your attention this morning.